Duncan Carmichael, a synesthesia researcher at the University of Edinburgh, is with us. Duncan, what's happening in James's brain to produce these strange sensory experiences?
Hi, Martha. Well, we think synesthesia is caused by a type of crosstalk between areas of the brain which wouldn't normally communicate with each other. So in most people, there's no real functional connection between areas of the brain that process different forms of sensory input. They don't activate each other. But in people with synesthesia, for example, there is clear evidence that these areas of the brain do communicate. So if you take the example of James in the previous clip, when he reads or hears words, they activate not only the language part of his brain, but also the part of his brain which deals with taste. Whereas in people without synesthesia, those parts of the brain are very separate and wouldn't activate each other at all. So it's this kind of cross-activation between what are normally separate brain areas that seems to give rise to this sort of synesthetic experience, really.
And so what's our current knowledge about the neural basis of synesthesia?
Well, evidence is starting to emerge that supports this idea of cross-activation. There's some functional MRI studies that show this simultaneous activity does indeed occur, actually. So colour letter synesthetes, for example, when they read black and white letters, the colour regions of their brain become active. So in effect, they're experiencing colour without actually seeing it. And there is more recent work which has looked at whether there are differences in the underlying neural structure of synesthetes' brains, and indeed this appears to be the case. So the areas which show this simultaneous functional connectivity, this cross-activation, there's more white matter connectivity between those areas in synesthetes, and so we can almost say that synesthetes' brains are wired up differently to non-synesthetes.
And is this a consistent phenomenon? Is it consistent within an individual? And is there any consistency between individuals? For example, is a certain word associated with a certain taste or colour, for example, in different people? Or does each person have their own individual take on it?
People often have their own individual takes. I mean, there is some kind of themes which do occur. I mean, for example, A often appears to be red, and there is patterns which emerge, but often people will have their own individual experiences. Often members of the same family with who experience synesthesia will disagree on the colours of letters they see. There is some kind of commonality, but often it's a very personal experience.
And is this something that varies with culture?
I'm not so sure, really. Someone did a study in Australia that took all the kind of books that had been published with different colours and looked to see whether there was themes that emerged, whether the books that people read as children linked to their synesthetic experience. And I think that didn't turn out to be the case, actually.
What can this tell us about the neurotypical brain?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though synesthesia is quite an unusual phenomenon, it can tell us quite a lot about how the normal brain processes information. I mean, the normal adult cortex is quite kind of specialised and quite modular. So the part of your brain that deals with vision, for example, only responds to input from the visual system, and the part of your brain which deals with auditory input will only deal with input from the ears. But in synesthesia, this doesn't appear to be the case. There's crosstalk between these different areas, and this may tell us quite a lot about how the brain actually develops. So when you're born, these specializations don't exist. They develop over time and over the first few years of your life based on the input you receive. So what we think the study of synesthesia can give us is a real insight into how this specialization occurs, because the synesthetic brain is obviously quite different and potentially develops along a different route. You know, so why do people with synesthesia retain this capacity to have communication between different brain areas, which people without synesthesia lose as they get older, you know?
And so what do we know about the inheritance and the genetics of this condition?
People with synesthesia, typically 40% of them have a first-degree relative with synesthesia in their family. And there seems to be particular inheritance patterns. For example, mothers are quite likely to pass synesthesia on to either sons or daughters, whereas fathers seem to pass it on to daughters only. One of the studies we're running in Edinburgh at the moment is really trying to identify genes that might be linked to the development of synesthesia. Some work's been done in this area to date, but not very much. We've identified a few kind of areas on chromosomes, or a few areas that contain hundreds and hundreds of genes that might be implicated in synesthesia, but there's no specific genes that have emerged that may be directly linked. And that's what we're trying to do with our current study, is recruit a lot of people with colour grapheme synesthesia, so people who see letters or numbers in colour, and sample their DNA and see which genes might be specifically linked to the development of synesthesia. So that's one thing we're trying to do at the moment. We suspect there's a collection of genes that are definitely involved in this process, but to date nobody's had the ability to identify them. That's one thing we're trying to do with this particular study.
Duncan Carmichael at the University of Edinburgh.
Martha, thank you very much. You are listening to The Naked Scientist with Chris Smith and Martha Henriquez. Still to come, we'll be investigating the placebo effect. How can a medicine that contains absolutely no active ingredients still improve a patient's symptoms? But first, though, let's take a look at some of this week's other leading science breakthroughs.